Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, if your guy doesn't appreciate...
Yes, Matt?
If your guy doesn't appreciate fresh fruit puns, let the man go.
I don't have anything to add to that.
I mean, you didn't even come with a pun tonight.
Neither did you, buddy.
All right. Well, this that pun was attributable to the unrivaled Indian Hills Community Center, whose sign many Coloradans have groaned at for years. And yeah, they have. There's a whole bunch of them that Will Styler has here. There's about, I don't know, 50 or so of puns from that community center. So thanks to them for that great pun.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, probably the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing great. We are going to talk dementia tonight with Dr. Anna Chodos, and we have a wonderful co-host. Paul, before you introduce her, can you please tell people what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As per usual, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you mentioned, we are also joined by frequent co-host, producer extraordinaire, just one of our favorite people, Dr. Leah Witt. Leah, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for that very kind introduction. So glad I could join tonight. And tonight we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Anna Chodos. She's amazing. She's a professor of medicine in both the Division of Internal Medicine and the Division of Geriatric Medicine at UCSF. Her clinical work is in outpatient geriatrics and dementia care. She's the principal investigator of Dementia Care Aware, a program to improve the detection of dementia in older adults that started as a statewide program in California, and Caregivers as Partners and Care Teams, a program to train healthcare teams how to incorporate patients' caregivers into the care we provide. Today, she's going to teach us about tips for detection, diagnosis, how to talk to patients and their caregivers, treatment of dementia, including some of the newer tools to the field, some of the newer medications, and we talked last time about the five M's. Well, this is going to be an episode focused on the mind M. And then, of course, we'll be talking a little bit about multi-complexity, medications, mobility, what matters most. So let's get into it.
And I wanted to thank the Penn Division of Geriatrics for helping to support the production of this episode with a grant, and also for supplying us with support from their wonderful fellows. So thank you to them. And a reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Our guest did have one disclosure. She received remuneration from Novo Nordisk for participating in a task force looking at the feasibility of incorporating biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease into primary care. That being said, the discussion on this episode was very fair and balanced. And with all that, let's get to the show. Anna, thank you so much for joining us. And the first thing the audience always wants to know about our guests, they've heard your bio, but they want to know, what's a hobby or interest you have outside of medicine?
Probably trying new food. We live in a great food area, so just trying something new as often as possible.
How about recently? Like, what's something new that you tried that you either liked or really hated? I feel like either one could be an entertaining answer.
Yeah, the thing I tried recently, which I hadn't seen before, it's not really that exotic, but it's, so you know an affogato where you pour espresso on ice cream? This was espresso on like a massive pile of whipped cream, and I actually don't recall what it was called, but it was definitely hit the spot at the time and was, and, you know, it was delightful.
Does it just immediately melt the whipped cream? Because like if you get it with like gelato in Italy or something, it takes a while for the gelato to melt.
Yeah, this was probably the sturdiest whipped cream I had ever encountered. It was like
it's a heavy whip.
It was like a whipped cream vessel almost for this coffee. It was amazing. So mostly I was just eating whipped cream by the end of it. But
my wife is obsessed with those. That's a recent thing. Yeah, that's a good recommendation. Paul, anything to say about that? You're a big foodie.
No, I mean, it sounds great. What is not to like about that? That sounds right up my alley. Like just caffeine and carbs. Like that's what could be better.
All right. Anything you'd like to ask before we dig into this mega topic tonight?
I always like the advice or feedback one. I feel like it's always nice to take advantage of the expertise of our guests. So any advice or feedback that you received at any point during your career that you think would be especially meaningful for our listeners?
Yeah, I think for, we're always learning. That's like one of the greatest parts of our careers and our jobs. It's sort of meta advice, which was at some point somebody told me, you know, if you don't have a mentor or somebody who's, you know, a couple steps ahead who you check in with and for advice, which I think sometimes does get hard in our careers, you know, especially after you graduate whatever training and maybe it's not as formal. The kind of mentorship that's available that, you know, but basically if you don't have somebody like that in your life, like go find them and go make connections and get that person in your life. And so I've always kind of adhered to that because, you know, you sort of outgrow relationships or mentoring relationships and then you're like, oh, I really need some advice. So it's always nice to have that somebody to go to.
That's evergreen advice. Yeah.
Very, very good advice. Yeah. Paul and I have some shared mentors that, I don't think I'm ever going to outgrow most of those people that I'm sure Paul has in mind too. So it is good to have people around you that like push you or pull you up with them, I should say. All right. Well, we should get to the topic because as I said, we have a lot to go through. Leah, would you like to read the first case and get us started?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Ms. D is an 84-year-old woman with a history of stroke, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, who presents to your office for a new patient visit. Her medical conditions have been well controlled on aspirin, atorvastatin, lisinopril, and metformin. She's here today with her daughter, who raises some concerns about her mom's memory. Her daughter says that Ms. D is still living in her long-time home by herself, but she has missed quite a few bill payments and gotten lost while driving in familiar neighborhoods. Both things are unusual for her. When you ask Ms. D about these observations, she knows that she's been having a little bit more difficulty at home, but attributes this to getting old. She says her mood has been fine, and she scores a 1 out of 5 on the MINICOG screening tool, and her PHQ-2 screen is negative for depression. So, Anna, I'd like to start off by asking you, how would you define what Ms. D and her daughter are reporting in the new patient visit?
Well, they're reporting some great information, and I think, generally speaking, I would start categorizing this as they're reporting some cognitive decline and some functional decline. And I would just start lumping it into those baskets. Obviously we have a great history and some additional information like her mood, so emotional or behavioral symptoms. But that's kind of where I would start my differential and thinking about how I'm going to work this up.
Are you starting to call things like mild cognitive impairment, dementia, or is it still too early to talk about those terms?
It's definitely not too early. I think obviously clinically we would start to go there. You know, we'd start to go there. So the big divider there between mild cognitive impairment and dementia, or what are the new terms, the new terminology in the DSM, which are minor neurocognitive disorder and major neurocognitive disorder, that's really divided along the lines of function. So is the presence of cognitive decline or reduced cognitive abilities compared to some prior baseline affecting day-to-day function? And of course, they're giving us some information that it seems to be, albeit kind of, you know, higher level functioning, it's still starting to affect her ability to function as she did before. So already, I'm thinking this is putting her more in a dementia category or a major neurocognitive disorder category than MCI or minor. So yeah, the terminology, just when they weren't working well before, we had to add more, of course. But we have, plenty of terms here to throw around. But it's basically just the evolution into minor and major neurocognitive disorder is to draw a better link between those two, and that minor is sort of the antecedent to major. So they're connected. They're a lot. They're the same thing. Whereas MCI and dementia don't really draw that connection necessarily, even though we learned it and it was sort of beat into us. So we have that in the background. But these are the new terms, which, of course, because they're new, nobody's really using.
Yeah, I have not heard anyone using those. I can see how it would be easier for patients. Paul, I saw you make a face. What do you think?
I mean, part of that's just, that's my face. But also, yeah, it seems kind of non-intuitive and then also non-descriptive. Like, it feels not terribly helpful. Like, neurocognitive disorder can describe one of a bazillion things, which I know is also true of cognitive impairment dementia, but I'm not sure. I don't like it is why I'm saying that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It sounds like some sort of like neurodevelopmental thing or, you know, some neuropsych term. Yeah.
Because dementia is really in the, like, you know, the lexicon. Like, people know what that is and they worry about it. So I still feel like you're going to have to be like, yeah, I think you have major neurocognitive disorder, also known as dementia.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is actually a good, this is a good point that often I will mirror what the way patients or caregivers or whoever's like giving me the symptoms and the way they're framing it, I'll continue to refer to it. And that way, I mean, I may add more detail or update it, but I'm not trying to add to the confusion, right, about what we're talking about. If I'm sort of following up, okay, we've been working up, you know, the fact that you're having trouble remembering things, if that's the way they're kind of framing it.
And what do you think about the mini-cog as an initial screening here? This person got 1 out of 5, so that's where you're asking them to do the clock drawing and you're doing the 3-item recall. Is this a good starting point for like case finding in patients, or if someone comes to you with concern for dementia or major neurocognitive disorder?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love it, actually. I think it's really doable, and I think it's a good sorting test, right? So that's the other thing is I think sometimes it feels burdensome to do these tests sometimes because then we have to explain them and know what they mean. And a mini-cog is really just a quick check, and if it's not normal, you want to follow it up. It doesn't necessarily mean that much in that moment, so that's why it just means this is a higher likelihood, you know, higher post-test probability person for having dementia or mild cognitive impairment, and we should follow it up. So no need to like over-explain it to the patient other than, hey, you know, we did that quick test. There was a couple of things on there that I'd like to follow up on, so let's keep working on this and do some workup. In this case, we have the patient and the family's buy-in. That's not always the case, right? Sometimes we're doing this test because we're noticing something and the person themselves don't have that insight. So I really like it, though, because in general, it's very easy to administer. You can adapt it to a lot of language contexts. It's certainly very usable and sensitive within people with lower education, which happens to be the population that I tend to see more often as people from different, you know, different backgrounds who haven't had a high school education. So it tends to be very useful in that setting. So I'm a big fan, big endorser of the mini-cog in primary care, especially.
I also love the mini-cog because you can do it on Zoom. I see a lot of patients on Zoom, so it's really quick and easy. They can always show you their clock and you can take a screenshot for the note.
Oh, that's a good tip. Pro tip, Leah. Thank you.
Love it.
So what would you follow this up with? Like, what other questions or screenings are you going to do for this patient?
Yeah, so we also have the advantage of having some functional information. I think in the moment, when you're in a kind of a screening moment or an initial assessment moment, the two key things to start to get your hands around are, what is their cognitive function? What is their function, which just sounds excessive, but as a geriatrician, love to say the word function. But no, I mean, so those are the two buckets. So I think the way that I always keep myself organized with dementia and a dementia evaluation is really around the fact that the criteria, this is like all the other things in the DSM. We're looking for a clinical syndrome that we can identify based on a list of symptoms, basically. And the cognitive symptoms is the one bucket and the functional symptoms are the other. So already, you know, they've given us part of both of those things. We basically did a little bit more on the cognitive workup than we did on the functional workup. So in that really early first visit, quick and dirty kind of assessment, I would also just get a fuller functional history. And that's the ADLs, or activities of daily living, and the instrumental activities of daily living, or the IADLs. So I have a little checklist that I use, you know, it's in my note template. And so that's really the initial part. But then, of course, is sort of like the big workup that we know is coming. And to organize myself around that, I still keep it in those buckets, meaning as I'm thinking through the information I need to get, I keep that organized in my notes and my sort of thought process. But I also know I can break it up. So the next steps in the evaluation really can take a while, and they often do, kind of regardless of how efficient you are as a wonderful, incredible primary care doctor. So usually it takes a few visits, like one, you know, I get an hour kind of at least, and that's so luxurious, and it's still really hard to get through it all sometimes. So the next steps in the workup are really going to be, you know, a really thorough cognitive history, and, you know, would love to go through some pointers on that. The functional history is certainly easier, and the really key thing you're trying to understand there is just, what are the changes and why? So obviously with a lot of older patients, the functional changes have a lot to do with physical or, you know, other reasons for not being able to do things that they could do before. So trying to get any clues that really it might be more cognitively related and less physically or, you know, medical condition related, which isn't always possible, is totally fair. Sometimes you can't really tell, and that's fine. But when you can, that's helpful. And then there's that little piece in the DSM-5 criteria where it's, you know, cognitive decline, functional decline, and then medical workup. And the medical workup, I think we're actually all just really good at, and it's really not typically something I have to remind providers to do. If they happen to send me a consult, they've usually done it. And it's a few labs to look for some of the more common, what we used to call reversible types of dementia. There are, you know, they are reversible, but or I would think more treatable, and then thinking about whether to sort of do some head imaging out of the gate if you think that's clinically, you know, likely that you're going to do some head imaging. So usually after somebody gets a positive mini-cog or starts to really get a report of a lot of symptoms from a patient, while they know they're going to schedule a follow-up to sort of go into more depth about the clinical history, they're going to also order some of those initial labs and imaging.
This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. You know, work can be so overwhelming. There's so many competing priorities, and we all want to spend less time on busy work and more time on high-impact work. What I love about Grammarly is that it works across more than 500,000 apps and websites, so when I'm working, it feels like it's following me around, helping me write better, and not just spelling or grammar. It's helping me set the tone I want. It's rewriting full sentences for me so I sound smarter. My writing is clearer. Grammarly saves me time and makes me more confident in the work and the writing I'm doing. And at Curbsiders, we're working on show notes, we're sending out emails, and we want to sound smart. We don't want to make mistakes, and we want you to experience Grammarly yourself. It can help you write compelling drafts in just seconds. 93% of professionals say that Grammarly helps them get more work done. When you have the best tools, you can get more done, and Grammarly is AI support that will work for you. Let Grammarly take the busy work off your plate so you can focus on the high-impact work. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. This episode is brought to you by Continuing Education Company. Are you a primary care clinician or hospitalist looking for high-quality, unbiased CME? For over 35 years, Continuing Education Company has been a trusted leader in accredited medical education. All of their courses are ACCME or AAFP accredited, offer ABIM mock points, and are completely free of industry support, ensuring independent, evidence-based learning. Attend a live conference at stunning destinations like Hawaii, Alaska, or Florida. With half-day sessions, you'll enjoy expert-led education in the morning and free afternoons to relax or explore. every in-person attendee also receives a free 15-credit online course and free 30-day access to conference recordings. Prefer to learn at home? Continuing Education Company has you covered with live webcasts and over 600 hours of on-demand courses covering topics like women's health, internal medicine, and hospital medicine. Missed the live event? Their on-demand replays let you experience past conferences at your own pace. And a special offer for Curbsiders listeners, save 30% off on all online courses and live webcasts with promo code CURB30. Visit www.cmemeeting.org/curbsiders and use the code CURB30. That's www.cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to explore all offerings and claim your discount. Whether live, online, or on demand, Continuing Education Company makes earning CME easy and rewarding. Continuing Education Company, educating clinicians, enhancing patient care. I want to kind of go back to the cognitive history pointers. That sounded, you know, I would love to hear those.
Okay, let's do it. It's so good. It's actually, so the you can always just go back to the DSM-5 and notice that they have six domains. So the main thing to remember is that it's not just memory. You know, Alzheimer's disease is the most common underlying neuropathological process that's causing the dementia syndrome that you're seeing. And that is sort of famously has short-term memory difficulty in the very early stages, which is why it's sort of big man on campus. Everybody kind of knows who Mr. Alzheimer's is and what some of his symptoms are. So that's why that memory symptom seems to be, you know, so emblematic of dementia. However, if you look at the DSM-5, it's one or more cognitive domains have declined or are declining. And it isn't memory and another. It could be any of those. So what they did when they changed the terminology, they also decided to like label all these cognitive domains in like really fancy ways. So they're also like harder to just intuit. But it is memory and learning. Yeah, wasn't that helpful? So helpful. It is memory and learning, which again, most people don't need a ton of reminders about what is involved there. But as I go through these domains, I'll just say like a couple questions I usually ask to try to understand if they're having difficulty in that area. And you don't need 10 questions. You need like one or two to just sort of get a sense. But memory, it's usually like, are you having more trouble remembering conversations that you've had recently, appointments? Are you losing things? And then for people who appear to be more advanced, it might be, you know, are you having trouble recognizing family members or, you know, remembering things about your life? And that might even be something you pick up in conversation and is not, you know, readily endorsed by the patient.
Do you find that you have to ask their caregiver, or like do most patients have that insight to be able to answer correctly about that?
Yeah, as I was like giving my explanation there, I was like meta-processing that obviously in a lot of scenarios, we are getting collateral information, kind of whether we're asking for it or not, or we're going to get it at some point in talking to the patient. This is one area where I think like clinic flow-wise can be really difficult. Like, am I really going to stop and call the daughter and have a conversation if they didn't come? But it is true that collateral is often emphasized as like a must-do part of the evaluation if you can get it. I have a lot of patients who don't, like there wouldn't be anybody to talk to. But if there is collateral you can get, it's always good to try and get it, because fundamentally, if someone's having cognitive changes, no shade, right? But they might be having difficulty reporting their symptoms. They may be unaware or just unable to report. So we usually do try to get collateral. If the patient comes with their daughter, which they did here, I usually start a visit actually saying, you know, I'm going to ask a lot of questions and do this visit. How do we want to do this? Do we want to do this together? Do we want to split up? I don't like to assume that they want that person there to begin with. And then I like to point out, actually, at some point, it'd be great if we split up. So I can, you know, examine or work with the patient for a little bit separately. And then sometimes I can actually use some of that time to talk to the caregiver or family member, informant, however you want to frame that, separately as well. I know we just took a huge digression, but yes. So a lot of times I ask the exact same questions or similar questions to a caregiver. Or if the patient's okay with it, I will say, hey, we just, you know, thank you for telling me all that. Is it okay if I ask your daughter a few things while she's here? And people again, it can be tricky because it's socially, is somebody going to say, no, please get my daughter out of here, or don't let her open her mouth while you're there? I think the other thing that happens, you guys probably have had this, is where like a caregiver's in the background or like,
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, mouthing that there's a big problem.
They're just like you know, they're giving you the functional history, and like, and then the you know, person in their life is behind them, like rolling their eyes and like, no, that's valuable information. Again, that means maybe it's a better scenario to talk to them separately at some point.
Yeah.
And again, you're not going to get, you don't have to be a perfect detective the whole time. Like, get some information. Under, you know, leave yourself a note. You might need to clarify some things later. I'm sorry, Matt. I think I cut you off.
Oh, I was going to say, so that's the memory and learning domain that we're asking about. Are they forgetting conversations, appointments? Are they losing things? What other domains do you hit on when you're asking, taking that history?
Yeah. So again, sometimes, you know, it's totally fine to like go back to that list. But the other one's language. That one's also like a fairly straightforward. But, you know, asking, because we certainly learn this in like general neuro, right? Like, you know, expressive and receptive language abilities. But like, are you having word finding difficulty? Is it harder to understand what people are saying? Or are you finding it harder to follow conversations? Of course, these things can be multifactorial in terms of why they're having those problems. Difficulty reading, you know, writing, just assessing some of those symptoms. Usually, I would say word finding difficulty is like the most common thing that people know to report. Another domain on the list is executive functioning. And I think of this as like, you know, the more complex tasks, like what is an executive doing? So multi-step things, like are any more difficulty preparing meals? You used to be able to prepare, planning a trip, planning an outing. Also, like making decisions, or is that getting harder? Honestly, like probably the best question around like executive functioning is, has your ability to manage finances changed? For most of us, that just gets difficult. And that's one of the signs. Somewhat related can be like some disinhibition signs. But then there's the other domain that we can ask about, which is behavior. As I mentioned, very exuberantly phrased as social cognition in the criteria now. And that really just means behavior. And this really is one that it's very hard to ask the patient. And although usually we're asking about mood, anxiety, delusions, hallucinations, all extremely common in dementia and not necessarily a sign of worsening or, you know, some, you know, special form of dementia necessarily. Like all of those things are very common. Leah, I don't know how you ask about behavior, but
Yeah, I think so much is, you know, really need to talk to the caregiver, family member, informant. Yeah, I think because those are, that's when there's kind of behind the patient's back sort of mouthing what they think is really going on. So I like what you said about how, you know, have that discussion together, but ideally a separate conversation too.
The other thing that usually informants will tell you is like changes in personality and behavior that's really unlike them. So irritability is a big one, you know, sometimes physical or verbal, you know, violence or aggressivity that would like never have been them before. So those are obviously really significant symptoms.
Paul, do you ever get the guy that won't bathe?
Yes, endlessly. And that's a practical, there's a lot of practical, bathing is complicated. So it's, even though you've done it a lot, it can be overwhelming. Some of it is physical in terms of being concerned about like being in a, you know, big wet space. It just feels unsafe, you know, once balance is affected and things like that. But the other is it's like multi-steps. It can be kind of confusing to keep track of all the things you're supposed to do in there. So and so it's overwhelming. And the question is, can the caregiver work with that, you know, that scenario and kind of help them address whatever it is that is preventing them from bathing or not? And then unfortunately, I have to tell some people, like, actually, it's not a health problem that they won't bathe, especially if they're not stinky. Just roll with it. Like, just change the clothes and move on, you know, like, or sponge bath, or sometimes people will just like be willing to like wipe down certain areas, and that's kind of all you're going to get for a few years, and it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I get wanderers too. That's the other one that, you know, you get a lot of complaints about wandering and not bathing. that's mostly wives about their husbands. It usually tends to be, just in my practice, but
yes. And usually the dynamic is that like the wife is still cognitively well while the husband is not. And women, because they're longer lived, will often have dementia later, although they're the predominant, like there's more women with dementia in the world than there is men, because than there are men, because those are the stats. They're okay, but you're getting me to another domain, which is on the list, which is visual spatial. And what you'll see people start to have trouble with is knowing where they are, getting lost, having trouble driving. So if you're in an area where people drive a lot, for us, it's like everybody takes the bus. But if you're in an area where everybody drives, they might start to have accidents. Falls is another one. So the visual spatial piece does also overlap a little bit with motor. And motor is one of the domains. So tremors, falls, a difficulty with fine motor movements. So for that, I ask, like, are you having any tremors? Are you having, any falls, which is, good Jerry practice anyway. Oh, trouble swallowing, constipation. These are some of the autonomic and motor symptoms. And so those are sort of on the list. And then we're doing such a good job here. I think I've forgotten how many we did.
I think we might. So we've done memory and learning, language, executive function, behavior, visual, spatial, and motor. So is that all of them? All six?
But you know what? I think usually complex attention is on there too, which I just think of as attention. I'm not sure what the complex is about. It's just, again, I try to simplify everything for myself because otherwise it would be hard to remember all this as well. But, attention is just, can you attend to things? Like people can't focus enough to read. They can't focus enough to watch the TV. And one of the confounding things there is when they're starting to have trouble paying attention. And I just ask, like, do you feel like it's harder to concentrate and stay focused, or, it's harder to stay on task? One of the challenges with that is then, like, that's almost a precursor to a lot of the other functions like memory and learning. So that's where, you might see, and if you're, super well resourced and people are getting neuropsych tests or something like that, you might see that there's like they're kind of parsing that out, like attention versus actual memory, and they're able to do that with their tests. I think also if you've done one of the more popular, free tests out there called the MoCA, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, that has like it labels what you're doing as you're going through it, and one of them is attention. And so anyway, so and that's like what we learned, I think, often in med school, like counting back from, through certain numbers or a word backwards, things like that, or is how you might briefly test it. So again, all of these things I would, to some degree, review or ask additional questions to a collateral informant, if possible. The one that's not on there that we do often also assess as like really a dementia symptom is sleep. So have you had sleep changes either in like the pattern of sleep, or the sort of dramatic one is when people are having REM sleep disorder behavior and they're moving around a lot, they're yelling, like their sleep is very different. And that's because that's a potential sign of Lewy body dementia, or, if they have Parkinson's, I think it's more likely as well. Leah, do you ask about sleep?
Yeah, definitely ask about sleep. I was going to ask if there's anything else to the history that you focus on, or do you move to anything on physical exam?
I never examine patients. No, I'm just kidding. I'm an internist, so no, I'm just, but yes. So the big picture, though, even as you're like, oh my God, do I have to slog through all these questions? And really the answer is no. So you have some that you like to ask, have a sense of why you're asking them, basically, that like there's different domains that can be affected. But really the sense that you're trying to get is the trajectory and severity. So I'm always, when I hear about these symptoms, so if you get a few symptoms that are clearly severe, meaning well outside the range of normal, and you know this even if you're not, a behavioral neurologist or a neuropsychologist, and if they're progressive. So the sense that you're trying to get is, okay, these are new and roughly when. And everybody says a year, literally everybody. But, you can start to be like, okay, well, Christmas 4 years ago, what was going on then? Were you organizing Christmas dinner? Because it sounds like that fell off at some point. When was that? So trying to give them landmarks, like that's how we can sometimes pull out some more concrete timelines? And then is it, you know, is it slowly progressing over that time, or has it been roughly this, you know, stayed the same, or is it getting better? Which obviously is the rarer scenario that it's getting better, but definitely happens. And then the other is severity. So severity, I think of as like, is it really a symptom we don't see in people who are aging normally, or just what we think of as mild? And is it another sign of severity? Is it happening more often?
Paul, we're in physical exam territory. Is this anything you want to ask about here?
I guess my question for you is, are there things that you're looking for every single time on the physical examination, or do you let the history kind of guide? Like, you know, if, like, for instance, if you hear the REM sleep disturbance, are you then sort of honing in on Parkinsonian features, or is that something you do every single time? Or, you know, how do you, is it always pulses? Because there's always possibility of vascular dementia. Like, what are the really key elements for the physical examination once you've taken this great cognitive history that you hone in on every single time? And then how else do you sort of approach it more broadly?
Yeah, you can. So mostly I do look for like signs of clear asymmetry, you know, some sign of a prior cerebrovascular event. And I look for Parkinson's signs, basically. Those are the two things.
Oh, now I feel very smart.
Yeah. And then because it is helpful, right? That is a branch in terms of it's more likely to be in the Lewy body territory than in the non-Lewy body territory, basically. And I think usually we do gait. So gait is just helpful because there's a lot of, you know, interventions where we'd want to support, you know, poor or unsteady gait. But also just, you know, and I think Leah can add something here too, but usually like particularly slow or unsteady gait is generally associated with neurodegenerative disorders. So the other reason, like thinking about all those domains, helps me just conceptually keep track of everything that you know, I'm looking for in working up a dementia is, it is, even though it tends to start somewhere, it is at some point a whole brain disease, and all of these domains are affected at some point. And so just being aware that, you know, I think the motor really brings that out, right? That it's not just these cognitive functions that we associate with socializing or being functional as an adult. And so the gait is often helpful.
Yeah, Josh, when we had talked to him a couple years ago, he said that he has this like kind of trick to get him in the ballpark. Like if they have dementia and they're older and they kind of move fast, they talk faster, it's probably Alzheimer's. If they're younger, could be Alzheimer's or frontotemporal. And then he's like, if they move slow and they have a bunch of vascular risk factors, it might be vascular dementia. And then if they don't have the vascular risk factors, or they have like some Parkinsonian features, you might think it's Parkinson's or Lewy body, depending on which came first. And I thought that was always like a good way just to like, that's like the quickest way I've heard to try to like type people without like, you know, knowing too much else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fully endorse that. That's awesome. That's a really good tip. And then I know that there's at least one screening tool out there that includes gait. It's like a quick visual memory and gait called the 5-cog.
I have not used that. Leah, what were you going to say?
I was going to ask two questions. Do normal age changes factor into your assessment of any of those domains? And does pre-existing like intellectual function, like a super smart person, does that also affect your assessment of any of those domains?
Yeah, I think the really helpful thing about starting to do the deeper history, as opposed to relying on, let's say, just a MoCA or MMSE or whatever it is you were, you know, feel most comfortable putting out there as an assessment tool, like a direct cognitive testing tool. The good thing about the questions in the history and the reason why it's great to get a feel for what they've been experiencing and over what time is because it's relative to them. And it is, we do have so much, and I don't mean this in the neurological term, but neurodiversity, you know, people's brains are very different and they've been exposed to so many different things over a lifetime. So it's very clear that people with lower education just aren't going to meet the normal cutoff and above for a lot of the tests that we use, because those tests, first of all, weren't validated in those populations. And so they don't really reflect how well they're really doing. So what I always think about with someone with a history of an intellectual disability or TBI or things that might have affected their baseline cognitive functioning, to really caveat everything and really make it relative to them. And so if we do a test, it's not necessarily unhelpful. It may be really abnormal technically based on whatever criteria, you know, they publish about abnormal versus not. But the helpful thing is knowing now that I have a baseline. So if something changes, I could compare. Of course, that doesn't help if they're like really at the floor, but and similarly, it doesn't help if they're at the ceiling. So higher education is associated with more cognitive reserve. And so people will have a lot of symptoms and be fine on these tests. So it does actually absolutely go both ways.
I want to bring it back to, so you said, like, when you think about dementia, you think about this as a clinical syndrome, you ask about the cognitive symptoms. So we went through those six or seven domains that we can ask about. We talked about the functional symptoms. So that's the ADLs, the IADLs. And then you talked about the medical workup. We didn't dig into that. I think it would be good just to say which lab tests you think are worth ordering. And if you prefer for the imaging, do you MRI or whatever test that you normally get when you're seeing patients?
Yeah. So the workups generally for truly, you know, we know they have a lot of cognitive symptoms if these things are present, you know, so B12, thyroid, HIV, and RPR or whatever test you have looking for syphilis. And that may have to, you know, obviously at that point you get more history from the patient. So, and some patients have no risk factors. And in those cases, it's okay to skip the RPR, sometimes the HIV. So that's kind of it on the pure medical for looking for a neurodegenerative or neuro-based reason for their symptoms. Of course, there's like a list, you know, a good 10 items long of medical or other conditions that affect cognitive presentation or affect or have cognitive symptoms that may be having a profound effect on their presentation. And so that is on my list of things as I'm like marching through my workup, is to also quickly assess for those things and if I need to do more workup there as well. So I'll come back to that. We'll just put like a pin in that. The imaging question is, I can't say I know a ton of places that have really, really limited access to imaging. So generally speaking, it is worth doing in everybody just in case you're missing something like a tumor or, you know, a head bleed that nobody had ever picked up before. The people, though, I would say like definitely do it would be, you know, some of these other risk factors like head injury on anticoagulation, separately. So on anticoagulation, head injury, if they are living with HIV, if they've had cancer, and you know, a non-skin cancer in the past, a non-melanoma skin cancer, if they're very young, so under 60, generally, you would definitely err on the side of getting head imaging. So there's like a short list of things, and then rapid onset, and that rapid is roughly under a year. So, and again, like I said, everybody actually does say a year. So the question is, how quickly is it progressing? And mostly, you know, you're looking for rapidly progressive causes like Creutzfeldt-Jakob or things like that. So your standard 80-year-old who's starting to have very mild symptoms, and they're very standard for Alzheimer's disease, I don't think it's very urgent that you get head imaging. But many people will, just to make sure they haven't missed anything.
This episode is brought to you by LocumStory.com. Full disclosure, what I'm about to say is a sponsored promotion for LocumStory.com. But the weird thing here is there's nothing they're really trying to sell you. LocumStory.com is simply a free, unbiased educational resource about locum tenens. It's not an agency. They simply exist to answer your questions about the how-tos of locums on their website, podcasts, webinars, videos, and they even have a locums 101 crash course. LocumStory.com is where you should go to find out if locum tenens makes sense for you and your career goals. What makes LocumStory.com unique is that it's more of a peer-to-peer platform with real physicians sharing their experiences and stories, both good and bad, about working locum tenens. Hence the name Locum Story. Locumstory.com is a self-service tool, which means you can poke through their content at your own pace with no pressure or obligation. So that's it for this sponsor promotion, which was sponsored by a completely free-to-use sponsor, Locumstory.com. Now, I heard Paul gets CSF studies on everybody. Paul, is that true?
Well, I was going to ask a different triggering question and say I was shocked to hear that we are not checking your analyses, the most common cause of dementia. so since we can, you know, treat a UTI and just repair people immediately. So I was shocked to hear that at least.
Well, I've been humbled, I guess, because it's already always done. So like the basics, obviously, like if they've never had a CBC or a basic chem, you know, yes, get right. Those things.
Are you ordering a CT or an MRI or?
So the reason for the MRI is it's like better structural information and you can see like relative atrophy better. But the CT really is acceptable in particularly in those like really, you know, no red flags cases, just to make sure, again, that there isn't anything there that you really missed. Again, tumor, big yeah. stroke, things like that.
So I know nowadays there are some CSF studies, whether or not Paul's ordering them, I think they're available.
So no, Matthew.
And so what about biomarkers, whether CSF or blood biomarkers? Are those mainstream? Should we be even thinking about them in primary care? Is that more still just limited to the specialist office?
So, yeah, I mean, you guys are so industrious and busy. You must be so busy with all these LPs. So big picture, the other thing I didn't mention, but I was sort of alluding to is we, you know, we're doing kind of a syndromic diagnosis when we start out, like, am I detecting clinical evidence of cognitive decline and functional decline enough to meet criteria for dementia and then ensuring to rule out some medical stuff? But the unspoken phrase there is I'm looking for a clinical syndrome because underneath is a neurodegenerative disease. And so really once you feel like you've gotten enough information about whether or not they have this dementia syndrome or major neurocognitive disorder. And of course, we're all, you know, thinking ahead. So we're thinking, well, what's underlying it? And there's like a massive numbers of various neurodegenerative diseases that can cause a dementia syndrome. And we already talked about the fact that Alzheimer's is the most common. But of course, there's Lewy body dementia. Again, it's not helpful that the disease and the syndrome are called the same thing, but that's okay. And then, you know, there's vascular, which is also incredibly common. Probably most people have mixed, so some combination of Alzheimer's and vascular. And then frontal temporal dementia is also one of the bigger ones that people, is playing a role. We know from neuropathology, whether or not we ever diagnose that while they're alive. So in a sense, these biomarkers are really intriguing because they give us the hope that we could actually diagnose what's going on in the brain neuropathologically before they die. Because really clinically, mostly what we're doing is we're making some good guesses based on the clinical presentation and that package of symptoms and how they've been progressing. Like this person's probably more likely to be suffering from Alzheimer's disease. This person's probably more likely to be suffering from frontal temporal dementia. And of course, since Alzheimer's is the most common, there's been so much work on that level of diagnosis. And that's where the biomarkers come in. So when people start talking about them, they're all looking for evidence of neurodegeneration because of very specifically the neuropathological process of Alzheimer's disease. So amyloid proteins or tau proteins, you know, some chunk of that protein that these assays are picking up. And in research, the gold standard has always been the CSF or these. So the PET scans that you hear about, the amyloid PET scans, are biomarker studies looking for evidence of amyloid. And now they've also, you know, some companies and you can, you know, your patients might be getting these on their own, like paying for them on their own, or their health insurance is paying for them. They're not FDA approved. So generally speaking, Medicare is not paying for them. But the blood biomarkers are picking up, you know, much, much smaller amounts of these same proteins that the CSF assays were picking up. Obviously, it's a lot more appealing in the long term if these really become part of our clinical algorithms that the blood-based biomarkers would be more readily available because a lot, you know, you guys are very unique in that you do LPs all the time, but, you know, a lot of primary care don't. And patients are a little, you know, overwhelmed by the thought. So, but right now, really none of those are incorporated, I would say, into your standard workup in a primary care setting or a general setting. And they're really still in the domain of the specialist and almost always used to add something to a clinical workup. So the person has symptoms, they have other findings of dementia, and they seem more on the Alzheimer's pathway. Okay, now we're going to get these biomarkers to confirm.
Yeah, so what I was reading, there's the amyloid marker. If that's low in the CSF, then that's suggestive of Alzheimer's. And if the tau proteins are high, that's suggestive. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the most sensitive one is one of the tau ones, like tau 217, I believe. And it's a later, I believe, like the amyloid plaques start, and then the neurons as they're degenerating produce the tau protein as well. So hence it's a more specific finding for Alzheimer's pathology.
Yeah.
But they've tried them all, and they've tried like other ones too, like neurofilament proteins and, you know, lots of different byproducts of the neurodegeneration.
Yeah, it seems, I think where I've seen the specialists ordering them is if they're trying to get people approved for the anti-amyloid medications, which I guess we can talk about briefly.
This was my bigger question is, how critical are these things to informing actual medical management? Like, I guess it's nice to have a name and a concrete diagnosis, but in terms of the things that we have in our armamentarium, again, we'll get to treatment in a second, but I guess, yeah, how far are we going in the primary care office, and how useful is this stuff going to be later on when we're actually talking about management?
So I think the reason this is not even really dipping a toe quite yet into primary care is because the treatments, you're right, that what's going on is they're saying, okay, we have people who have dementia symptoms. We're verifying that in a bunch of different ways, which they're going to do in the specialty setting. So like a huge neuropsych battery, a bunch of definitely an MRI and additional imaging and things like that. And then, in a clear assessment with the clinical history, usually with like very specific surveys and things like that. And then if it's sort of more typical of Alzheimer's, the biomarkers they do essentially confirm that there's Alzheimer's pathology going on in the brain. And then that obviously is a more appropriate target for what they call the disease-modifying therapies, these monoclonal antibodies that clear out amyloid from the brain. That's the primary goal and effect of these antibodies. So when you look at the studies of the two medications that were approved, lecanemab and donanemab, you know, people's brains have much less, almost essentially no amyloid after the treatment protocol. The thing is that those treatments are very intensive with a lot of, you know, it's frequent infusions, a lot of monitoring, and potentially severe life-altering side effects. And so that is really, you know, in the specialty domain, you know, if different treatments, you know, come down the pike or are easily prescribed by it from the primary care setting, I think that's when it'll really start to, you know, enter our clinical pathway. But right now, I think that's why it's still really in the specialty pathway. And that makes perfect sense to me. And that's why you really do need the biomarkers. You need to really confirm that they have amyloid pathology if you're going to give them an anti-amyloid drug. Leah, do you have more thoughts on the...
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you when to refer, because we're going to get more into treatment in a second. But you mentioned earlier that maybe higher resource patients are getting neuropsych testing. I'm guessing we can't do that for everybody. There's not resources for everybody at CashLAC. Our neurology department's really impacted. So when would you refer to a neurologist or geriatrician? I can imagine patients who advocate for themselves more strongly are getting referred and maybe getting these treatments more often.
So generally speaking, being in a consultant role myself, like anytime you want a specialist help, like I hope you can get it. And should, you know, dementia does clearly, it confuses everyone, including us as clinicians. And sometimes there are symptoms like we're not really sure what to do with, or we're not sure if it's, you know, something that should be managed differently. But the big picture is that the milder the patient, probably the more appropriate for a specialist. And I guess there's like kind of a tipping point there. Like, are they so mild, you know, they you know, are only complaining of, you know, certain subjective symptoms and there's nothing objective on your exam, you know, no functional impairment. But these medications are only even appropriate in people who are either kind of preclinical, so no functional impairment, minor neurocognitive disorder, or this is so confusing, major neurocognitive disorder, mild stage, meaning dementia, but very mild.
No.
I know, terrible. Oh my God, it's terrible. I know. It's so hard to keep track. But so basically mild dementia or MCI or, you know, like no functional impairment or very minor. This lady, honestly, would be, but you know, from what we know so far in the case, she might be a candidate. But I also think like that huge workup with like often a lot of like hours of neuropsych testing and hours of history with a specialist, that just doesn't serve somebody who has advanced functional impairment and advanced cognitive deficits. Like they're not even going to get through it and you're not going to learn. Like it's, you know what they have. But I just want to give a sobering stat, which is about half of people with dementia never even get a diagnosis, like die with dementia and don't have a diagnosis. So we are not finding or we are not naming dementia in many patients. And almost always people are diagnosed in moderate to more advanced stages, meaning their symptoms are so obvious, like we feel very comfortable giving them the diagnosis. Okay. And of course, it's always hard with the milder patients. So I would say one thing we could all challenge ourselves to do is think about, could we be a little more proactive in identifying dementia earlier or, you know, cognitive decline earlier and trying to work with who we have in our network to sort of refine that referral pathway and figure out like, who's it best for them to see? Who's it, how can they help me manage these mild patients?
Yeah, my soapbox on this topic is that it can't just be in the realm of primary care doctors to be diagnosing dementia because a lot of patients don't have a primary care doctor. And I think any specialist could learn to do a mini cog if they feel like something is a little off or patients are complaining and maybe flag that something could be going on.
I'd like to bring it back to our case just so we can go on a little bit. So just to remind the audience, we have an 84-year-old woman, Mrs. D. She has some vascular risk factors. She's had a stroke before, high blood pressure, diabetes. She's in the office with her daughter. She's having some issues with paying her bills, some memory loss. She got lost driving in a familiar neighborhood. So Leah, do you want to take us to the next part of the case?
Sure. With some additional questions, you find out that Ms. D is still independent in all of her ADLs and most of her IADLs, but she's been having trouble following a recipe when she cooks herself dinner. She's also forgotten to turn off the stove on a few occasions. Her daughter has found several completely full pill bottles in the house and missed days on her pill box. Ms. D wears glasses, but she does not have any problems with hearing. Her neurologic exam is unremarkable except for a mild action tremor. Her gait is stable without use of assistive devices, and she has not had any falls in the last year. Ms. D scores an 18 out of 30 on her Montreal cognitive assessment, missing all points in delayed recall and only able to remember one of the words with multiple choice answers. And her geriatric depression scale is 4. Based on this information, you decide to start with a basic workup with labs and an MRI. Her lab work testing for reversible causes, the TSH, B12, CMP, they come back normal. Her brain MRI shows signs of small vessel ischemic disease and temporal lobe atrophy. She and her daughter come back to your office for a follow-up visit, and they want to know exactly what is wrong with her memory. They want to know if there's anything that can be done to improve her memory or prevent it from getting worse. So I guess let's start by interpreting her lab results or her test results, her MRI, her MoCA. What do you think of those tests?
So yes, we know that her MoCA is an abnormal score and it's sort of like mildly abnormal. Again, that really, really depends on educational background. Most of my patients, well, that would be a great score. And so you probably should be adjusting for age and education. So our scores get worse as we age and they get worse. Or like the normal cutoff should probably be lower for people with lower education. So that's the only thing I might explore a little bit is, what her education level is. Obviously we saw her test results as they almost always do came back normal. Most brain MRIs come back normal and that doesn't mean nothing's going on, just to point that out. If a neuroradiologist does comment on atrophy. That's extremely helpful since we're not neurologists and we didn't spend 4 years staring at brain MRIs and don't feel comfortable reading them ourselves. But something like temporal lobe atrophy is more typical for Alzheimer's disease. And just, you know, I think if any of us have seen an MRI of somebody with more advanced dementia from any type, it's like very atrophic. So again, this would suggest this is also a kind of a sign that maybe she's milder. Because as we're already kind of picking up clinically, but because we can tell relative atrophy. The small vessel ischemic disease is also like extremely common, especially at older ages with this sort of past medical history she has with diabetes and hypertension. But it can, in it sort of like cumulative effect, cause cognitive difficulty and decline. So it's not irrelevant if that's all you see and the person has symptoms. It could be, you know, a sign of, you know, a contributing factor. So I would sort of review this with her and say, we noticed this. So here's how I generally talk to people about their diagnosis. So in my mind, she's reporting, you know, significant cognitive symptoms. She's reporting significant functional decline, but, you know, from a baseline. She has evidence objectively, if you want to say that, on the cognitive tests that we did with her, that she has some abnormalities. And then her brain MRI supports that she has some irregular atrophy, which isn't normal. So with sort of all of that, I would say you meet criteria for what we call dementia. And all that means is, and then I just explain, like you have a cognitive decline from how you were before, and this is affecting your day-to-day function. That's what we mean when we say that word. In your case, the MRI gives us some suggestion that this may be due to something that's called Alzheimer's disease. And like in my note, I would often say, you know, has dementia because she meets these criteria and the likely etiology is blank, is how I sort of always frame it for myself. So I keep those things kind of organized. And, you know, obviously, especially if you're delivering a diagnosis and they're pretty hungry for it and ready to hear it. So what questions do you have? Let's talk this through. The other thing a lot of clinicians will do is stage it. So mild is sort of mild, major neurocognitive disorder. I know Polly's your favorite. You seem to be like really thrilled every time.
But, it's also not major mild because that's just seems, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah, that would be, yeah, you're right. That makes no sense. So I would say, yeah, you have dementia. Again, usually with patients, I would not use minor and major neurocognitive disorder, but you have dementia and we would consider this mild stage because you're having difficulty in your IADLs. And you're still able to do all your ADLs. And then once people start to have ADL impairment, it's more in the moderate. And then we know that people are categorized as severe when they are, you know, really dependent in almost all their ADLs. There's a little bit of fudging there with the, you know, do you need like one ADL impaired to even be mild? I think some people, and then some people use rating scores, like a FAST rating score or a clinical dementia rating score. Again, I think it really is, we're talking relative terms, like you're relatively mild, which means you're going to live longer with this condition. And we have things to look out for.
Yeah, it seems a little subjective. It seems in practice, you don't often see in charts people necessarily labeled unless they have like advanced, I'll see people write advanced dementia in there when it's just obvious to anybody that that's what they have. But usually I'm not seeing as much people writing mild, moderate in the charts. But in my opinion, you can kind of get that sense just from talking to the patient and the family and seeing them a couple times as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so tied to prognosis, like knowing that you're going to live with this for many years when it's mild versus, you know, you probably, so it's on average people have 8 to 10 years when they get a diagnosis at, you know, when they're like MIS-D. Whereas if they're more moderate, so ADLs are really starting to be impaired, it's more in the, you know, 3 to 5 year range. And then when they're advanced, it's like the 1 to 2 year range. So
do you talk to them about prognosis for like how long can they be living alone? How long can they manage their own money by themselves? Does that come up?
Yeah, this is a great time actually to meet a patient and to make this diagnosis because she is so independent still and engaged in her care. I don't march that out for them specifically, in part because it can be a little idiosyncratic and very like related to the resources they have sometimes more than anything else. And there's actually a really important feature of this particular patient, which is she lives in her own home. So sometimes we see a big drop off in abilities or function when people are moved for whatever reason. You know, sometimes it's intentional assisted living or sometimes it's not. So I've seen people do way better than you think they would for way more years because they're in a very familiar environment with like a very familiar routine. Yeah, I would just say, you know, it's great that we are finding this now. And I'm going to just take a little tiny right turn, which is because there's so much we can do, part of what we can do is plan for the future and really learn about what the symptoms you're going to have going forward. But also there's, and this is really my big message of the day, it's you can start brain health plans, which really are like the core care plan of dementia, more so than, you know, I think we're mostly practicing now.
Mm-hmm. And then a few safety issues to flag. She's like leaving the stove on and driving. Are those things that you're trying to intervene on right away? I think in some states you're a mandated reporter and that must be difficult to navigate.
Yeah, so definitely, thank you for flagging that. Definitely addressing, you know, acute safety concerns and knowing whatever your reporting laws are in your state. So like for us in California, we have to report to our local Department of Public Health and if somebody has dementia. And I always do put the stage because I think that helps them make decisions because often what they'll do is have a conversation with the DMV. But this is actually a person who has sort of like somewhat more urgent social service connection needs. So getting connected to there's tons and tons of dementia organizations. Like this is exactly what they do is they help people figure out how to manage these symptoms, like leaving the stove on, wandering. And I always start talking about how, you know, this is often a very new way to sort of manage a caregiving, care recipient relationship. Often they're not even intentional, right? You know, maybe the daughter and her mother, like, didn't intend to have this relationship, but now they do. And so it really is a job that many people get zero training for. So, you know, I say this is often there are symptoms that we don't know how to manage. They're very different than other types of, you know, chronic conditions. And that's why there are all these organizations that are very, very helpful to help us learn about it, to help us manage it. And probably the most helpful thing are peer groups. Like I always say, I admit that I have not taken care of somebody in my family with dementia and that other people who have been through exactly the same thing. Sort of like everybody's going through exactly the same thing completely alone, like, you know, on an ongoing basis all the time. And how can we tap into, you know, the shared wisdom of our peers? So trying to connect people to support groups. Very specifically for the stove, I often, you know, give advice about like finding ways to deactivate the stove or just remove the knobs and keep them somewhere else. And then things like wandering. There's lots of tips and tricks to help people reduce wandering. So covering up exits, as long as you know how to get out if there's a fire or something like that. You know, sometimes putting like a black mat in front of the front door, people won't go past the black mat. They don't sort of, there's just lots of tips and tricks. And again, the dementia and Alzheimer's organizations will usually like have tons and tons of these.
Yeah. Do you have any favorites? We can link them in the show notes. Like I know Family Caregiver Alliance is really good. Any other favorites?
Yeah. I think the Alzheimer's Association, which is national and does have a lot of like local chapters. And then in California, in Southern California in particular, we have like Alzheimer's LA, Alzheimer's San Diego, which are sort of separate organizations. But they're really great. And probably the most helpful thing is the Alzheimer's Association has a 24-hour call line. So I often make sure people have that number if there are behaviors like this, because, you know, of course, things happen at all hours. And they do have like a fair bit of language capacity.
Can you tell us what you meant by brain health plans and what might go into that?
Yes. So what I mean by brain health is, so I do work with a program where we start screening programs for dementia. And if even the screen is positive, we start a brain health plan. Because really, the core of treating cognitive decline, cognitive symptoms, and functional decline doesn't change once you have a diagnosis. So sometimes we like waste those like 2 years not improving cognition and function when we could have been because it's really nonspecific. So the core of the brain health plan are like two things which every primary care doc loves, which are encouraging physical and social activity and managing blood pressure, the vascular risk factors, so blood pressure, diabetes, and high LDL. So those are modifiable risk factors and associated with slower decline and including less development of dementia in general. So these are all sort of just, we know them to be like general good brain health practices. The other ones that are a little more specific to dementia and that I think maybe we're not as familiar with or not doing for other reasons are correcting hearing and vision and like being a little bit aggressive about that if we can. Hearing in particular, not being able to hear or losing the sense of hearing really tanks the brain. And like, it's not really, there's a bunch of reasons why. Hearing loss sort of also contributes to some of the social isolation and like lack of social engagement that also reduces brain function. The issue with hearing loss, I know I find in my practice, is getting hearing aids and getting people to use hearing aids or corrective devices. That's probably a topic for another day, but at least attempting to emphasize how important that is to brain functioning. So hearing impairment, early life education, and LDL, I think, are the biggest risk factors, modifiable risk factors. Lancet does a update on modifiable risk factors for dementia every year, and hearing impairment is huge. And then the other one is medication. So this is where the geriatrician comes out like kind of fierce. But getting rid of those medications that really slow down the brain. And it's really meds with anticholinergic burden and sedative hypnotics and a couple other things. But I usually do the like anticholinergic burden calculation. So nerd out on that. But it's acbcalc.com. And ooh, you want to like just this. You want to reduce the cholinergic burden. A lot of meds have like are like sneaky about their cholinergic properties. And then, of course, like the benzos and the sleep aids.
Yeah.
So that's a brain health plan.
Paul, that sounds very much in your wheelhouse to be able to do all those things.
Yeah, no, that sounds like so many things. Squarely primary care. So I'm excited to hear that I can actually make some kind of meaningful difference in promoting health. Above and beyond that, we've keep threatening to talk medications, and I know that our listeners are going to be anxious to hear your take on that. We've talked about them in prior episodes too, but I guess what should the primary care doctor be comfortable with, and when is the right time to consider those medications?
Right. We'll just like leave to the side because we already talked about the disease modifying monoclonal antibodies, and those really are in the specialty domain, and we're not going to be prescribing them. And the only way you can like facilitate if you feel For the patients who may be a good fit for those medications, I think the only way to facilitate it is be pretty proactive in detecting it among your patients and figuring out how you would connect them to the specialists who would help them with next steps. But the general, all the rest of the meds are symptomatic, and I don't think any of them are particularly necessary. But in the spirit of helping patients feel better and maybe occasionally doing a little better, there are some medications to try, and there's really only two groups, the anticholinesterase inhibitors and the NMDA antagonist, which is there's only one, memantine. And so the typical one for the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors is donepezil. Sometimes people use rivastigmine patch because it's like easier to administer. You know, people, it's easier than someone who doesn't want to take pills or won't take pills or forgets to take pills. So And they're symptomatic, and the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors are approved for mild to moderate dementia, and then memantine is approved for moderate to severe. And you don't have to, you know, basically I talk to patients about them. I let them know that sometimes they help people with symptoms. So some people just feel better. They feel like their brain's working better on them. And I don't, if that's of interest to them, I don't necessarily want to deprive them. I do let them know there can be side effects like weight loss, nausea, diarrhea, insomnia, dizziness. So we want to look out for those things. So if I put somebody on that, I will check their weights. And I always start slow and titrate up. And I make sure to just follow them and check in, see if they think it's helping. In geriatrics, we're pretty clear that if something's not clearly helping, it's only hanging around doing harm. So we don't look for mild benefits. We're not interested. If it's not really helping, if they're not like, this is great, I'm doing so much better, I don't feel the need to continue it, but I usually say we should try it for 6 months and see how you do and get you up to like a dose that you feel you can tolerate. And kind of the same thing with memantine. And then you don't have to prescribe them both just because, you know, if one didn't work and they're sort of a candidate now for memantine and you want to try it, go ahead. It's kind of a number of the same side effects.
Should we move to the monoclonal antibody therapies, which we started to talk about before, but would she meet criteria for this? Is she early enough?
She's early enough. They would do like a dementia clinical scale. So maybe she'd come up too high on that, but she definitely could be early enough with just some IADL impairments. And then she would, they would go through the process of probably verifying with the CSF and a PET scan that she has Alzheimer's pathology. So that's kind of the missing piece. And then you really need somebody who can be monitored. I think for primary care, though, the important thing to know is if you happen to have a patient on this, is if they have a headache or some mental status change, it's really important they get scanned.
Yeah, because the bleeding, right, they can have hemorrhages. And the one article, I guess, I don't know if it's a famous story about the woman that, like, she had a ischemic stroke and she went to the hospital. They gave her, like, TPA and she was on lecanemab. And then, like, she just, like, died. She started screaming in pain and, like, she just started bleeding profusely, like, intracranially because of the medication. So I don't know if that's, like, a warning now. Like, you shouldn't give TPA if people are on these. But that case sounded horrifying that it was, like, immediate when they gave it to her, supposedly, if the article I read is true. But
yeah, I think, again, it's also your perspective on, when you see the original trial information, if you think it's a lot or a little of people who are having these consequences. So they actually, the main side effect that they look for and they would stop the medication at least for some time is, they call it ARIA, and it's amyloid-related imaging abnormality, something like that, or anti-amyloid imaging related. But it's really fundamentally, that's why they're proactively imaging, and if people have signs of either edema or hemorrhage, so there's ARIA-E, ARIA-H, they would stop it and wait and decide whether to proceed again. And obviously, if they had a serious bleed or a serious neurologic complication from edema, they would probably not restart, I'm guessing. You can't be on it if you're on an anticoagulant for that reason. So, that I'm sure excludes a lot of people. And yeah, I just think that that's a very consequential side effect and one that might deter a lot of people on top of sort of like, it's not typically chemo-like side effects every day, but it's sort of like a chemo-like regimen, frequent infusions and imaging. So it's a very intensive treatment. Again, the other thing is people who have a genetic predisposition with the APOE4 alleles have a higher risk of those side effects, the ARIA complications, and kind of a bit of a tragedy there if you think that maybe they'd be more likely to benefit or it could be like fast-tracked or something like that. But it's a caution to really, these patients should know about it. Again, I do think as generalists, we're not going to have that conversation for a while with patients and it's not going to be quite routine. But if patients are on it, to really, they should hopefully know to let all their providers know.
Can I ask you, frankly, I know that those medications are controversial, especially the first one was like sort of approved by brute force, it seemed, and then now it's no longer approved. And then lecanemab and donanemab maybe had a little bit more evidence, or at least the studies had a little bit more positive findings, but I guess some people were not super impressed with the benefits or the effect size. So are you a believer in these, or what's your just general feeling as a field, people that deal with this disease a lot, are most people believers or not?
I think on balance, most people in geriatrics are not huge believers in this or hugely inclined because of the tendency to sort of downplay these serious side effects in some of, these studies, which is pretty standard for a clinical trial to downplay the side effects. The other thing is that's not really clear is, the reason these were improved, they had a clinical endpoint as opposed to the first one, aducanumab, I think only had like a, pathway endpoint, like, amyloid's reduced, as opposed to patients actually are progressing more slowly. But that's the other thing. People progress more slowly. They don't not progress. Mm-hmm. So that's why this is still in the realm of disease modifying as opposed to curative. Mm.
And I think part of the controversy was also cost. What does cost to the healthcare system and then cost to the patient look like?
Right. Tens of thousands of dollars. I think the cost of lecanemab, I thought per year, not per dose or anything, but per year was like $23,000 to $26,000 or something.
Yeah. And then when I was reading that when you add on the cost of the imaging, that adds like, you know, cost beyond that. So the cost is, it's a lot per year when you add all that up.
I mean, from my standpoint, you know, certainly the people included in the trial were so mild that who among us is detecting, right? We do not have a proactive way to detect very early, and certainly not MCI level cognitive impairment, unless people are advocating for themselves.
Yeah.
So I think it's worthwhile to detect super duper early because there's so much we can do to support the brain and have it be healthier and have whatever they have going on progress more slowly, no matter what, with all these very low hanging fruit, affordable interventions. But regardless, we now have this really fancy disease modifying therapy that essentially I wouldn't have a single patient I could refer, you know, also because we don't know how it performs or if it's appropriate in mixed dementia and, you know, other types of dementia. And, you know, we just don't have that many people who are preclinical and identified.
And we'd be remiss if the other reason they're controversial, that, you know, that one article that the amyloid paper where the results were faked. So that also cast, you know, a shadow over the whole amyloid hypothesis. And yeah, so it just, as a non-neurologist, non-like brain doctor, someone who doesn't deal with this like all the time, I just, I'm still confused and still waiting for smarter people to sort this out. Like what's real, what's not, you know, how excited should we be about these therapies?
Yeah, we have time. I will just say, like, one side of working with people living with dementia and their families and their support systems in general, I think it is hard to be, to not want to have a little bit of hope, though, that at some point we can change the course. I think I revere my patients no matter what's going on with them. I have seen many, many positive things coming out of people living with dementia and that affecting, even though it's affected their life and their families. But I think a lot of people would want the opportunity to have a different course for their life if they could. I will say that is the other thing that as patient advocates that we could be doing earlier, which is helping them to plan their lives knowing that they have this going on. I mean, we really rob people of that chance when we detect later because sometimes they can't participate as well. They haven't had the chance to set things up to get, you know, to think about it. Mm-hmm. And then we often are doing it in like crisis situations or things have really kind of come apart. And that's a really bad time to do that kind of planning and thinking. It doesn't mean it all goes smoothly and beautifully just because somebody did some advanced care planning like 4 years earlier, but it is something that gives a little bit of more autonomy back to the person and allows them to know what's going on with them. And to me, that's a far better reason to be looking earlier and trying to detect earlier.
That's a fantastic point.
And just this drug. Yeah, I don't really care about this drug, to be honest, at the moment.
That's a fantastic point. Well, we've taken way more of your time than we planned to, so I think we should sort of start to wrap up the case here. Leah, do you want to read the conclusion, and then I guess we can get take-home points?
Yes. So after hearing about anti-amyloid therapies, Ms. D and her daughter decide against it. So you decide not to pursue any specialty referrals or biomarker testing. You start Ms. D on donepezil. She returns with her daughter a few months later, and she's actually tolerating it well and feels like she's improving or stabilizing. Her daughter has started helping her out with a few of her IADLs, including getting her set up with a rideshare app, helping manage her finances, helping manage her medications. She set an alarm on her mom's phone to remind her to take them. And then Ms. D has also started visiting her local senior center and is taking a few exercise classes there. So that's the summary for Ms. D. Let's wrap up by maybe some take-home points. What take-home points do you have for us, Anna?
I had a fabulous time. Thank you so much. I love talking about this topic. I know it's a lot. I feel the energy lagging. But no, like big, big picture, if everybody can just take home, you know, from thinking about this condition, that often we can really recognize the signs earlier if we just like keep in mind that there's, you know, a cognitive decline, a functional decline, and we need to feel comfortable with some tools to assess both those things, both historically and objectively. And that at any point, starting the brain health plan, which again is pretty simple, we have these tools, does so much for the brain in terms of improving progression and improving overall functioning. That concept of involving whoever's in their life, if they have that person, or even maybe more importantly, you know, working with the patient, they don't have anybody in their life, but starting on sort of that like advanced care planning, thinking about the future pathway is really, really crucial, because these folks are like our highest risk for having crises, for having incapacity, you know, having trouble making decisions later. And we sort of kind of set them up for those crises if we aren't addressing some of this earlier. And then there's a lot we can do, you know, symptomatically around all the symptoms they have without necessarily leaning on the dementia medication. So I think it really is about treating their symptoms and them as a person and addressing quality of life throughout. It's the work of caring for somebody with dementia, even if we feel like we don't have treatments that we can just keep pulling out of our white coat. You know, this is really a clinical area where we don't want to confuse not having treatments with not being able to care for somebody.
Thank you so much. I don't think our energy is lagging. And I think it's because you made it so simple. You know, you made this a lot more straightforward and simple. And I wonder, I know you have a lot to plug because you have done a lot of statewide, nationwide education about this topic. Can you share with us a little bit? Plug what you've been doing.
Oh, sure. Oh, like actually me. Oh, I was going to plug other people's stuff.
Plug whatever you want, but plug yourself
well,
too.
We have, we do have dementiacareaware.org where we sort of just really focus on like this early detection moment of, you know, how you would screen and how you would incorporate that into practice. And it may be helpful to some folks. We do know that like the biggest question for all of us, right, clinically is, well, then what next? So we are working on that. But right now that website is sort of our home for like early detection energy. But I really wanted to plug, because I think they're so interesting and just do incredible work, is a group called Dementia Minds, dementiaminds.org. I think they might actually be like the National Council on Dementia Minds or something. But they're really trying to do more in incorporating the voice of people, like people themselves living with dementia. And I think that's an important piece that very understandably kind of fades away as people get more impaired. But the lack of centeredness sometimes of people in their care with dementia, and that I think is like our mode in medicine sometimes. And you know, just the invisibility, the lack of audible opinions from people living with this condition. And I'll just point out, like, not too fine a point of it, but you know, Bruce Willis has sort of faded from view, right? And he has aphasia, so I can understand maybe why he's not talking about his condition. But a lot of people who have suffered with Alzheimer's have really faded from view. I bring up celebrities because it helps us remember that it's not all Alzheimer's out there. Robin Williams, you know, he died not knowing what he had and why he was having so many symptoms, but he had Lewy body dementia and, you know, ultimately had like very significant depressive symptoms related to that. And then, you know, another example is Wendy Williams. She has frontal temporal dementia and she's kind of off the beat. So it's understandable at a certain point, people aren't going to be out there, and visible with their symptoms. But I think Dementia Minds really does a lot of great work to help us, give us ways to understand what people are going through. And I had a real privilege to meet with a group of doctors who are part of Dementia Minds, and they all have a diagnosis, a very early diagnosis of different causes of dementia. And I was just really grateful for that. And they all had to advocate for themselves to get a diagnosis and to get a workup. And understandably, they knew how, and they knew what they were, that they were having real symptoms. But, you know, most of our patients aren't going to have that level of self-advocacy. So I think about them a lot and how I can learn from them to help us all do, you know, feel more comfortable addressing this milder, because it is hard for all of us.
All right. Well, we will head to our outro. Thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Anna. That was amazing.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
See, now we know you're a pro, unprompted. Right there, strong work, Dr. Wood.
Thank you.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Meg Heller and Leah Witt, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at PodPaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Waddle runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Waddle.
And I've been Dr. Leah Witt.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, thank you and goodbye.